You're listening to Let's Talk Macro,
brought to you by Bandhan Mutual Fund.
Hi everyone, welcome to Let's Talk Macro. Ahalya here, your host, keeping you company once again on the podcast about macroeconomics, brought to you by Bandhan Mutual Fund, where, as you know, we talk about all things global and domestic macroeconomic and really deep dive into different topics and events with, of course, the help of Srijit Balasubramanian, economist in the Fixed Income Fund Management team. Welcome back, Srijit. Thank you so much for being here, as always.
Yeah, my pleasure, Ale. How are you doing?
Doing very, very well. Just for the audience, it was a fun coincidence because Srijit and I crossed over on our communication about when we were going to record the episode without knowing it. So it's clearly something we both look forward to. Now, just to set the context for today's topic of conversation, you know, markets across the world have been constantly assessing and reassessing the outlook of major economies and what that really means for central bank policy expectations. Over our last few episodes, for those of you who have tuned in, you will know that we've discussed this particular aspect for the major advanced and emerging economies. But today we're going to take a little break from that and talk actually about one specific economy, which is China. China recently announced measures to bolster domestic growth by addressing the property sector and consumer demand issues. Again, two things that we have touched upon briefly in our past episodes, but today we're going to really deep dive into the property sector in China, its linkage with the domestic economy, and some of the features that are unique at play there. We're also going to then look at the raft of fiscal and monetary policy measures that were very recently announced by China. That will then help us understand their significance for markets and what could really lie ahead in terms of further measures. So we're going from the micro to the macro. So Srijit, before I ask you any particular questions, could you just, you know, start us off by setting the context of, you know, what's been happening in China over the last few years? Because honestly, I think for the whole world, the past 4 or 5 years has been like a whirlwind, and China is no exception.
Sure. So first of all, consumer demand started getting weaker in China pre-pandemic itself. Now, China witnessed very strict COVID lockdowns based on their zero COVID strategy, and pandemic-related fiscal stimulus for households was also limited. Property sector deleveraging was ongoing, and this was causing pain to the sector and the whole economy. And if you remember, in 2021, some developers started defaulting on, you know, their debt payments and so on. Right. And in 2022, China persisted with its zero COVID strategy when other countries started reopening. So there was uncertainty about economic reopening alongside, you know, ongoing property sector and consumer demand issues. Last year, that is in 2023, reopening was expected to unleash, you know, pent-up demand and thus give an impetus to global growth. But this disappointed. So this was again reflected in commodity prices as a greater than expected part of domestic consumption went into services also. This year, the economic weakness has continued and China has been announcing incremental measures, but mostly on the supply side to ease, you know, financing and so on. But markets were looking for measures, particularly fiscal measures, which are, you know, bigger and addresses consumer demand and the property sector more directly. But until very recently, such measures were missing.
Okay, so fiscal measures with scale and targeted to address the issues with domestic demand and the property sector were also largely missing all this while. But before we talk about all of the recent developments, Srijit, could you talk to us a little bit about the significance of the property sector in the Chinese economy? Because this is also what we opened the episode with, and when we've touched upon China and, you know, the different measures being taken, the property sector just keeps on coming up. So how is it kind of linked, maybe even, for example, to the household sector?
Yeah, so on the significance of the property sector, to give you some numbers, more than 90% of households in China own homes, with more than around 20% of households owning multiple homes. By value, if you see, households hold more than 60% of the assets in real estate. The real estate sector is also estimated to have a fairly large share of more than 25% in China's GDP and almost you know, just under 40% share in government revenue. And for local governments, this is even higher as they rely, you know, heavily on land sales and property-related taxes. Now, what these numbers really imply are the wealth effect on households from the property sector is quite strong. That is, the fall in home prices will have a strong impact on consumer sentiment and spending. So it's no wonder that CPI inflation in China recently has remained very soft, because consumer demand has been very weak. Now, the property sector also has a strong impact on local government revenue, like we said, and therefore their spending and borrowing. In fact, some reports recently said many local governments have cut compensation for government workers, which then, you know, reduces home sales, property developer income, their funding needs, and labor income growth. So the property sector in China has a strong and broad economic linkage through various entities. Households have been facing a negative wealth effect and weak income growth outlook, particularly given the pre-sales system in China. Therefore, the current issue China has been witnessing really needs some targeted and heavy measures to fix them.
Yeah, very interesting, you know, this strong connection between China's property sector and the overall economy, because it's, again, it's just so micro to macro. So not surprising in a way that these things can be a bit of a vicious cycle then and take some really meaningful measures, right, to break them. So you just talked also about the pre-sales system and how that's something very unique to, you know, China's property sector. Could you talk about exactly what that is, how it works and how it impacts the household sector as well?
So it's a common practice that houses are pre-sold to buyers well before construction is completed, right? In China, a large share of new home sales uses this system. This is widely used by developers for funding in addition to their borrowing, and their reliance on proceeds from pre-sales had also risen strongly. The issue is, although developers are required to maintain some part of pre-sales proceeds in, you know, escrow accounts, which are regulated by local governments, the regulation varies by province. And it is reportedly common for developers to use these pre-sale funds to purchase land for other projects and even repay debt in some cases, which then eats into the funding for construction of homes for which, you know, these were pre-sold in the first place. The Pledged Supplementary Lending Program, or the PSL program in China, through which financial institutions have provided lower cost funding, also apparently fostered this practice of pre-sales. Now, in 2021, developer financing became a bigger issue, and some cities really tightened regulations around the usage of pre-sales fund. But this sort of ended up aggravating the credit crunch for developers. So subsequently, there were some efforts to make these regulations consistent across regions, that is, sort of consistent regulations nationwide, and to tie the release of pre-sale funds with phases of, you know, progress on construction. The other important thing here is that home buyers are required to pay the full amount upfront on pre-sold homes. And that's actually a big thing. So for households, if you see the loan EMIs start right away when they actually purchase a pre-sold project, and they assume the entire risk therefore. In the current situation, what happens is households have to keep, you know, paying EMIs while project completion and delivery have been delayed. So that's a quite a big burden for households, if you see.
First of all, a very unique system of pre-sales there, and also puts a big sort of, you know, puts a lot of onus on the households, right? And in a situation like the current one, that can be, I think, quite a big ask. So Srijit, does this then mean that policy is mainly focused on this aspect of housing? Is that where the problem lies, that it's such a narrow focus, or?
Okay, so I would say policy so far has not been explicitly or solely focused here, but measures to address the broad housing sector were announced. For example, there is a program for lending to state-owned enterprises to enable them to purchase homes. But this is mainly for homes which are finished, but unsold. The offtake here for this particular scheme has also been quite low. The broad call instead has been for central government fiscal measures targeted towards, you know, sold but unfinished homes through lending support, which is the kind of projects that we just discussed. Now, this could happen alongside measures to support domestic consumption and, you know, support local governments as well. In fact, the IMF in its recent Article 4 publication in August suggested something similar to restore home buyer confidence. Now, despite acknowledging that the housing market correction since 2021 is necessary for a more sustainable path and that even structural reforms are also needed. The IMF specifically said, the forbearance is sort of allowed non-viable developers to remain in the market, you know, slowing project and that is project completion and eroding home buyer confidence. It recommended central government intervention to compensate buyers or complete projects if developers are in insolvency procedures. Now, if developer is solvent, but only financing is an issue, then central government could offer risk sharing capital or guarantees, for example. Now, such a scheme, according to the IMF, could cost around, you know, 5 to 5.5% of GDP over a period of 4 years. So the broad recognition of pre-sold but undelivered homes is a main focus area is there, but measures and specific measures are still yet to come by.
Very, very interesting, Srijit. First of all, a lot of policies that, you know, I had no idea about. And I guess we can only hope for more policy focus there. And that kind of brings us to the recent slew of measures that have been announced by China. Markets have taken it very positively, it seems. So what was all of that about? What were the measures and what do you foresee as the impact?
So from towards the end of September, there were several measures announced. More important, I would say, was the acknowledgement of the problem, the growth problem, and the intent to take concrete measures sooner than later. The main measures included rate cuts. So the 7-day reverse repo rate, which is the main policy rate there, was cut by 20 basis points. Banks' reserve requirement ratio was, they said they will cut it again by 50 basis points, and it could be cut further by 25 to 50 basis points this year. Existing mortgage rates were cut by around 50 basis points. And the minimum down payment for second home buyers was cut from 25%, and it was aligned with that of first home buyers at 15%. And this is expected to benefit many households. So that's on the rate cut or the monetary policy side. Now, to specifically support the property market, it extended some of its previously announced policies till end of 2026 and allowed the scheme that we just mentioned, which allowed, you know, local state-owned enterprises to, you know, sort of borrow 100% of the principal loan amount now, which is previously 60%, to, again, which is primarily to purchase unsold homes and convert into affordable ones. That's on the property market. It also announced measures to support the stock market. For example, a Yuan 300 billion facility to fund share buybacks by listed companies and shareholders, and another Yuan 500 billion swap facility for insurers, brokerages, and fund management companies to purchase stock in return for pledged assets was announced. It said the amounts under both these facilities could be, in fact, tripled if facilities turn out to be successful, and that it is also studying the possibility of an equity stabilization fund. Now, if there is enough demand for these facilities, China could pump more money here, and you know, it could be quite useful, especially the equity stabilization fund that they're looking at. Additionally, it provided a rare aid of direct cash handouts to those in extreme poverty, and released a document which detailed several points to help support employment, because youth unemployment in China has been rising quite strongly. So overall, if you look at it, it was a departure from the supply side measures it had been taking all this while, and this time it seemed much stronger and targeted.
That definitely seems like, you know, significant steps being taken there. And I also like the call out about the acknowledgement, you know, Srijit, about the growth problem. I remember reading about this meeting the same week, which also I believe laid out the strategy going ahead. Yeah. Did that meeting kind of happen? What was that about? And was it important? Was some of the results important?
Yes, this was the scheduled Politburo meeting, which unusually focused on the economy, because most previous September meetings apparently haven't. It actually also called for direct consumption support. So for instance, just to give you some details, it called for increasing countercyclical fiscal and monetary policies, now issuing long-term special treasury bonds and local government special bonds to drive government investment, and also, you know, lowering the deposit reserve ratio and implementing a strong interest rate cut. It in fact stressed on the need to stabilize the real estate market, promote a new model of real estate development, and also boost the capital market. This time, it also called for combining consumption with benefit for people, that is by enhancing the, you know, the income of the middle and low income groups, and even cultivating new consumption formats. We'll have to see what that means. But so, quite a strong display of intent there, like you just mentioned at the Politburo meeting, with focus on multiple important areas like, you know, income, consumption, property, and capital markets, and the need for direct government support and intervention here. So again, a very clear focus on growth, and there is the expectation of more announcements as well. So it's not really surprising the equity market, for example, has taken it very positively.
Okay, good to know. We like, you know, more things coming through the pipeline, because then we get to discuss more on the podcast. Yes. Are there any specific measures that you're going to be looking at or looking forward to?
Yeah, so China, the Golden Week holiday from 1st to 7th October, there is a very wide expectation of further measures to be announced anytime. Now, as the advanced economies are now cutting rates, obviously it would provide some broad comfort on easing rates domestically. That's on one hand. On specific measures, I guess the possible areas of focus could be the sold but undelivered homes, like we discussed, capital markets, support for revenue hit local governments, and domestic private consumption. In fact, some provinces have already announced issuance of vouchers to support consumption. And there are also some reports that China is planning to inject yuan 1 trillion through special central government bonds. Also, you know, these numbers keep varying and we'll have to look at how that entire amount is getting used. So we'll have to look at the actual magnitude of fiscal measures. And if implemented through local governments and not directly, that is, the incentives there for effective execution of the program. If it ticks all the right boxes, then we should see commodity prices respond to higher demand from China. So, and hopefully some respite also from the excess supply of certain Chinese goods in world markets as local demand improves over time. Of course, in the background, there'll be geopolitical factors and structurally unfavorable demographics in China, which will continue to have their impact.
Okay, so, you know, going forward, we're just going to have to assess how effective policy measures will be on various fronts. But, you know, there could be measure announcements in the weeks and months to come. So, again, as always, going to be a time to look forward to and keep us on our toes. We've really covered quite a bit on China's economic context, you know, the significance of its property sector, which I'm very glad that we've done, Srijit, because it's something that's come up in our podcast before. And, you know, also the various measures announced recently and what we should be looking at. So at this point in the podcast, as always, it's time to leave our listeners with the key takeaways from today's episode. First up, China has been facing weaker consumer demand and property sector issues for quite a while. The property sector is very closely and strongly linked to the economy through households, local governments, developers, and so on. Household demand was negatively impacted as property prices are down, projects are undelivered, capital markets are weak, and income outlook is also weak. Second, the unique pre-sales system in China supported developer financing while households pay in full at the time of booking and take up all of the risk. So in the current situation of a property downturn, this severely impacted household demand. So the pre-sold but undelivered part of housing is a major issue, and even the IMF has recommended direct central government measures to revive this and support private consumption. And finally, China also announced a slew of measures, including rate cuts and steps to support the property and capital markets. The Politburo meeting also made the intent to support the economy through various angles clear, and this was taken positively by the market. So we could see more measures in the weeks ahead. I mean, they could be in progress as we speak today, which are likely fissile, but we will have to look at the scale and the final execution. So that's the summary of our discussion today. Some very interesting and unique insights coming through. Thanks, Srijit.
Yeah, I think that's a great summary. I think it was just last month that we said there's been no broad change in the China story for quite some time. I guess it's definitely more interesting this time.
No, absolutely. Yeah. For all of you who haven't, you know, been keeping up with the times, this is the way to do it. Make sure to tune into our previous episodes. You can find them wherever you stream your podcasts. We really do believe that you found today's discussion useful. Thank you, Srijit. And yeah, we'll be back soon with another episode of Let's Talk Macro. Thank you.
Mutual fund investments are subject to market risks. Read all scheme-related documents carefully.